All right, so final exam review. Looking for the timeline here. I feel like, am I mic'd right now? Like an echo. Let's see, maybe that's a little less eerie. All right, today we're doing a final exam review. So in the next couple of minutes here, if you have any questions, sort of prepare them. Otherwise, Wednesday is when the group project presentations are due. So just looking for a video file, 10 minutes or less, that communicates your pitch along the lines of the rubric and the way I've kind of described. You'll just upload that to that assignment. And then after 11:59, when I confirm that everybody's got those in, I'll give Canvas the okay to assign peer reviewers. And so I think I'm only asking for you to do one review. So that will mean that then starting on Thursday, then you'll go back to that assignment. And if you go to the peer review assignment, it'll give you instructions on this, but you'll go back to where you or your group member uploaded the group assignment and be able to click on the peer reviews button, which, depending on how big your window is either down at the bottom or if your window is wide enough over to the right. And then you'll be able to access the presentation that was assigned to you. You watch it and fill out the rubric, provide some constructive comments, and make sure to hit submit after you fill out that rubric and do the comments there. So unfortunately, I think next to the video, there will be a little button that says view rubric. I think you have to click that to show the rubric, and then you'll go through and you give your scores, and then you can either comment within the rubric or give comments at the bottom. And then you'll submit that, and that will be due Saturday. So down here. And then so then during finals week, I will go through all the videos as well as all the peer reviews, and I'll score the peer reviews. And that's basically if you left constructive commentary and provided a rubric score, you'll get your check mark. It's like a one or zero for in most cases. And then I'll also assess the presentations, and then a portion of the presentation variance will be explained by the peer reviews itself. So you'll play some role in providing the grades to your peers. And then I'll kind of modulate that based on how I want things to go, trying to bias things more towards the positive grades, the negative grades. And so that helps sort of correct against different people's scales and so on and so forth. So that's the presentation idea. And then the exam is that then tonight around midnight, the stage one of the exam will become available. So I put Thursday here because that's formally where we're doing it, but just to give people a little extra time, then I'm going to make it available Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And I decided Saturday. So it will disappear Sunday morning. And then that way I've got all of Sunday to, if someone just happened to not turn in their stage one, I'll be able to sort of send them a bunch of annoying emails Sunday to say, hey, you're going to turn this in. And so because I want to make sure to give everybody an opportunity there, because if stage two opens, I have no choice but to give whoever hasn't turned in stage one a zero on stage one, because stage two is then open at that point. So I'll have a little bit of a buffer there so I can bug people who haven't submitted by Saturday night. But you'll have all of those times, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, to submit stage one. Whenever you start it, you get 90 minutes. If you would like to come here Thursday at the normal class period to do it here in a quiet environment, that's totally fine. We'll be here and able to kind of sit on the room while you're doing that. But you don't have to. You could start it Wednesday. You could do it Thursday, elsewhere, wherever you want to do it. But it is locked down for stage one. And then during finals week, I'm going to open it up Monday. And so then stage two will be available Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And so you'll get all day those 5 days, and then it's collaborative. If we will, I think Tuesday is the day that Tuesday morning. I think Anushka will be here Tuesday morning or Thursday. Is Tuesday or Thursday? Do you remember? Doesn't matter. It's on the calendar. And so, but it's not at the normal class time. It's at just that one exam slot that's on the calendar. And so if you would like to come here to use the space to collaborate, then that will be available, but you don't have to. So, this could be the last time you see us is today is totally fine. Just hopefully we see you on Wednesday for that upload. So that's the timeline there. So any questions about what's expected? Yeah. No, that if I don't, as much as it's fun to see a couple of these, then it's excruciating when you have to sit through 20 plus of them. So I don't see any value to that. Maybe the next time I teach this course, I'll convert this to a discussion assignment. So when you upload it, you can review it. And so then you at least have a choice to see what some other people did too. The downside of that is it makes in Canvas, if you upload it as a discussion assignment, the peer reviews automatically are forced to be non-anonymous. So just to try this thing out for the first time, I'm not doing it as a discussion, but in other classes, sometimes we do a discussion, and then at least you have a chance to see more than one. But no, I've given up on, I've taught classes this large or larger, and sometimes you burn a week or a week and a half on presentations, and nobody likes it, including me. So I like to have the time to watch your guys' stuff, but not necessarily trying to cram it all in and manage the timing and flag people for going over time and things like that. It's yeah. So no in-person presentation, just purely upload the video and then watch it. And again, feel free to go shorter than 10 minutes. Yeah, so I ideally the intent was no. So that I know that there might be some things that you write on that sheet, but it's meant to be your last kind of exercise where we're making the sheet is supposed to be a reminder. And if although it seems functional to just carry that sheet over, I'm less interested in giving you the sheet and more interested and giving you incentive to go through the process of making a sheet. So sorry, I know it seems like this would be easy. I'll just take my pre-midterm and I'll make a post-midterm and I'll have my nice reference. But again, it's not my goal for you to have the reference. It's my goal for you to sort of consolidate the information. So I'm forcing you to make a new sheet or use the old sheet and just try to cram stuff in the margins. Other questions? Oh, yep. So, stage shoes on Thursday. Is it morning or afternoon? 2:30, right? So the window here during finals week is 2:30 for 110 minutes. So 2:30 to 4:10, 110 minutes. So that it will be staffed during that time, but you don't have to come. But if you'd like to come, and then you can talk to each other. Like it's not like it'll be proctored. It'll just be like one of us sitting up here, and then you can just chat amongst yourselves. It's always fun for us to listen to you guys work things out too. So we enjoy when you come. Other questions? Okay. So basic format, it's really very midtermy. It's designed to fit within a 75-minute space. So I give you 90 minutes just for technical issues, exactly the same as the midterm was. There's usually nobody who's got this class reserved afterwards. So on Thursday, if you came here, most likely you got the whole 90 minutes inside this class if you really like the idea of taking it in this space. If somebody does come at the end of 75 minutes and say, "Hey, we've got this room booked for an event or something," then we'll have to kick you out. So there's that risk. But it's designed to finish in, at the same time that the midterm was designed to finish. So, most people will take an hour. Some people will be in the distribution close to half hour. Some people will end up taking 75 minutes, but most people taking 75 minutes or longer will be double checking their work, hopefully. So that's the goal of the design of the midterm. It is primarily, so lockdown browser stage one, it is about 35 to 40 points, just like the midterm. The emphasis will be on post-midterm stuff, but I'm going to try to, the pre-midterm stuff's fundamental. So if whenever I can weave the two together, like if I ask you about a self-defense mechanism. It'd like you to recognize that that's a an explan you know an explanation for a self-defense behavior that comes from the mechanistic that of Timbergen's 4. So being able to spot Timbergen's 4 in topics that come after E through J is definitely something that's important. Well, there may be questions that are specific to A to D, or they might be mixed in with questions that are assessing content from E through J. So, we talk about communication and signaling and cues and signals, and handicap principle comes up in that. And so there was a bunch of stuff after the midterm that involved signaling. So you could imagine that there'd be signaling questions that kind of, are like the communication unit as well as the unit they come from. So I, whenever possible, I will try to not ask questions that are specifically pre-midterm, but fold them into questions that are post-midterm. But if there's a really important fundamental concept that I would like to assess, I reserve the right to put in a couple of questions from the pre-midterm, but it's meant to assess primarily the post-midterm, which is kind of an integrative study units anyway. So, automatically graded, no essays, exactly, very midterm format. Again, the tip here, unfortunately, so there's a problem in, there's two types of quizzes you can give in Canvas. One of them, if you run it with lockdown, it's impossible to see your answers between. The other one, you can run it with lockdown, but the only way you can see your answers is to also only see the correct answers. So, unfortunately, I don't have a mechanism to show you what your answers were between the two. So, again, I'm going to give the tip that bring some scratch paper and just write down your answers at the end of your stage one so that you have them for stage two. And then no scores or answers will be released between the stages. Stage two, again, open book, open notes, open Canvas, no lockdown. You can collaborate with anybody currently enrolled in the class. You can use Slack, you can use Discord, et cetera. Just make sure that the only people participating in that channel are people that are enrolled in the class. That's kind of what's there. So, and but of course, you don't have to collaborate as well. So this stage two can be individual, it's just option. Oh, yeah. Sure, that right. Yeah, that's unfortunately, yeah, this stage one, stage two thing is sort of been added post hoc. And so they don't have. Like Canvas has basically stopped developing that product. And so you can imagine like, a feature request that like because two-stage exams aren't a thing that I invented, that they could create like, I want to create a two-stage exam. And whatever random choices were made on stage one, it will then randomize that there. But unfortunately, right now it does a reshuffle. Even if you take stage two multiple times, like if you submit and you're like, oh shoot, I want to change my answer, and then I'll do another attempt, it will reshuffle for that second attempt. And there's no way I can tell it not to shuffle, but I think there's advantages in shuffling. Because I'm going to have it shuffled and I can't have it. So all I would say is rather than writing down the whole answer, if you can find a keyword, like that, oh, this is the answer that says bird, or something like that. Maybe that's more, helpful. But I recognize it would be great if the letters could. Yeah, I can do that. Yes, I will go through and all the UCEs I'll go through and I'll check the let you see the answer block. I think I probably actually intended that. I just unfortunately in the new quizzes it's not that's not by default and I forget that and so I have to go through an automatic. So I'll go ahead and do that. Oh, and speaking of UCEs, I didn't mention this, but I put out UC is all the way up through J. And so J, I'm still working on while I'm working on the final exam. But if you're looking for more UCE opportunities, those have been available now. You can take those. But again, because we're dropping nine and there's only 10 of them, then if you've already done well on a UCE, it's not going to affect your grade any. But if you want extra practice, those are out there. And I'll do exactly that where I'll turn on the answers. Other questions? Quick comment before we go into review stuff, I hope some of you got a kick out of some of the topics. I'm sorry, question? You're good? Okay. Yep. It would, yeah, I conceivably I could make copies of all 10 UCEs for practice. This is one of those also frustrating things is that in other LMSs, you can do exactly that. You can say after, we've taken the scores, then allow them to take the rest. But Canvas doesn't provide the inbuilt way, so I have to duplicate all 10 of them and then set them up as practice assignments. And that's something I can do, but it'll just take a little time. And so if I can, I can do that. Yeah. Other questions? All right, so before we go into review stuff, like I said, if you hopefully some of you enjoy the kind of topics in this course with sort of an intro to animal behavior. So we covered a lot of topics, I know, but it's a very rich field. And so there are a lot more things that we could have talked about. And it was kicking me like when you're like, oh, I didn't cover mobbing behavior and other things like that. Like there are a bunch of things that that I can't believe I didn't cover the oxpecker example. Those sorts of things that like I view as classics, but I also view all the other things that I talked about as classics. And there's just only so much time. There's a lot more you can learn about animal behavior. If you're interested, we do have some courses that are kind of nice follow-ons to that. I've mentioned 436, sociobiology, behavioral ecology, which is offered in the spring. That sort of goes into the more social behavior side of things. 435, you actually get to do animal behavior research with, living organisms in the field and in the lab. I think it's kind of a fun course. But then in general, animal behavior is one of our handful of organismal biology courses that really are about, comparing across taxa and understanding diversity and things like that. So although these like courses like 385, 386, and 370 aren't directly behavior courses, the diversity in the strategies that you see across invertebrate zoo, entomology, and vert zoo are a lot of them directly intersect. I mean, now that I hopefully you see, like, if we think about Timbergen's four, I mean, animal behavior is about why things are colored the way they are. It's about why things are shaped the way they are. Morphology, morphometrics can relate directly to behavioral questions. So when you start learning about, when you start cutting open sea stars and things like that, you start realizing there's a behavioral connection there too. So if you're interested in this stuff, there are other courses to take. So just my little pitch for that. So, all right. Yeah. So, any other questions? All right. So, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put up an eye clicker where all I want to do is put in the word yes. That's it. You're here today. Anybody who puts in that yes gets a one for attendance today. Anybody who's not in there gets an excused absence. It's a little better to have a one than an excused absence because, it waters down anything else. And then after that, if you don't have anything else that you need from me, then if you don't think it's helpful to be here, then you can leave. I won't have any other eye clickers today. But otherwise, I'm happy to take questions about the topic material and where I'm going to go next year before after I put this eye clicker is basically highlights from the post midterm slides. And if we get through all those, then highlights from the pre midterm slides. And if you see something, you're like, oh, that reminds me that I need help with this particular subject, then you can raise a hand and we can talk about that. So that's the plan here. So let me put up that eye clicker just to give you a little credit for showing up today. So I'll just do it as a short answer. And so no question, just the word yes, you were here. Are you here? Yes. So if you put in yes or why, then that is a coherent answer to that question. And there's no other eye clickers today. So I'll leave that up and running. So meanwhile, any topic questions before I just start going through the highlights? And again, if this isn't useful to you, you don't have to sit around here. It won't hurt my feelings if you leave. All right, so again, stop me whenever needed here. But so after the midterm, we went into movement, fundamentals of movement here. So, the terms that are on Canvas there. As a reminder, we talked about this idea of path integration and the fact that animals can, after moving around, keep track of where their home is. So we talked about a lot of the mechanisms and functions of path integration. And so homing, the goal of getting home there, orientation, orienting your body, and path integration, quick returning to safety, and the different behavioral methods that are used to see that an animal is doing this path integration. These are core concepts, like knowing what path integration is certainly an important thing. We talked about movement. You can have random movement, as in for search. You can also have directional movement. So, when that crab is scared and it comes back, it moves randomly to search for a burrow. Once it sees the burrow, it moves towards the burrow. So, different categories of movement and different ways that movement can be modulated by the environment. So these are, like levee flights is this idea that even when you're moving randomly, you might have long periods where you don't turn much, and then you hit an area where you start doing a lot of turning. That's a so-called levee flight. So, these can be built into more complex behaviors where you start, say, following a scent gradient. So, we talked about, turning into and out of the wind when you hit certain odor plumes and how that can lead you to go towards an odor plume. And these are just, again, random samples from those slides. Talked about different taxis that are correspond to that. So good terms to know. I am not, this movement is a small area, and these are fine-grained details about movement. I am not going to ask a lot of questions about whether you remember the difference between tropotaxis and clinotaxis, for example. So I wouldn't worry too much about, the different taxis, but knowing that there are these different things that you can, move, you can take an average and move between two stimuli, or you can turn whenever a certain stimuli is there. I mean, knowing that there are these different responses to stimuli is probably more important fundamentally than remembering these specific terms. And likewise, knowing all the prefixes, I'm not going to test you on whether you remember geo is a prefix that means that you can sense gravitation. But know that there are a diversity of different sensory stimuli that you can get there. We talked a little about triangulation, sequential and simultaneous triangulation. This idea of do I have two sensors, or do I treat my head as one big sensor and I move my body around? That's kind of an important thing to remember, and it's I think that's pretty easy there. These again are get into kind of the weeds. And so those weedy small grain things I wouldn't worry too much about, but it's good to know that that diversity of description exists. The idea of allothetic versus the kind of egothetic, where do you get this sort of information? That's important. The odometer, this idea of odometry, I think is important. Idiothetic, I'm sorry, not even to egothetic. These ideas of there's internal cues and external cues, those things are important. Then we moved on to homing. We kind of built up from that, more complex stuff there, focused a lot on homing, a lot on path integration. So navigation, homing, this is again rehashing a lot of the stuff we talked about in movement. Just trying to get out of the movement area because we have a lot of movement slides and we talked a lot about fine-grained details, but I probably will only ask you one or two movement-related questions. So there's a lot of material here, but but I don't feel like this you should feel like you need to become a movement expert. But this is the, just a rehashing of, these were, I think, were the highlights from those movement slides. So that's why I'm kind of going quickly through here. Again, odometry, there's different types of odometry, mechanisms, and so on. So let's sort of get out of the movement here. Again, I want you to know path integration. I want you to know homing, that, and I want you to know different stimuli that animals can use to help them navigate. And those are sort of the important things. All right. So I think we're getting kind of towards the end here of all the crazy things that animals can do just to figure out where they are. And then moving to a slightly different subject, migration. Knowing the difference between just your average leaving the burrow and coming back to the burrow, and then large scale movement, that's an important difference. So knowing about that, knowing about dispersal, never coming home, and how there are different reasons to disperse, different types of animals disperse. Knowing that dispersal is different than migration, is different than homing, I think is valuable. So that's movement. It was a lot of slides on movement, but I went through them quickly because it's not a subject that I'm going to ask you a lot of questions on. But are there any questions about movement that I can help you with? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say, I might use a movement example to sort of gauge whether you're able to say, is this explanation more mechanistic or more ultimate, for example, more adaptive. So you could say, like, is what is the, I could ask something about how a crab moves, or ask a question that I could propose an explanation for how a crab moves, or I could propose an explanation for why a crab, makes a beeline to its burrow. And if I propose those explanations, it would be nice to know that you could sort those explanations out, and that this one's proximate, this one is ultimate. I might say that, well, the crab, in order to navigate, or the honeybee, honeybees do these things called orientation flights right after they become mature bees. And so after they egg larvae pupae, then they when they the first time they leave the nest, they fly in random patterns near the nest, and they seem to be encoding the environment. So they develop a sort of map over time. So, I could propose the, I could sort of say, like, here are these different explanations for movement behavior, and then see which Tinbergen bin do they fit into. That's probably more how you'd expect to see me use movement, more as an example, rather than seeing if you recalled a lot of stuff about the movement. So foraging, though, I mean, it's one of the four Fs. Remember I said, fighting, fleeing, foraging, and reproduction, the so-called four Fs of behavior. So foraging is certainly an important and foundational topic. So, in foraging, we didn't have that many definitions here, but I think a lot of difficult topics. So the difference between, plants and animals has to do with where they get their energy, and that effectively drives animals to do a lot of behaviors, a lot of them movement related. And so, in order, they not only have to move to find food, but they also have to move to do all the other things that, all the other Fs. So they're this idea that you not only have to forage, but you have to forage in such a way that you minimize the opportunity cost is super important. So your goal as an animal, a strategy that will likely be selected theoretically by natural selection, is not one that gets the most amount of food, but gets the most amount of food in the littlest amount of time, because that allows the animal not only to meet its energetic needs, but also do other things like prevent itself from getting attacked, or find a mate, and so on. So this idea of opportunity cost is really central, and it drives a lot of foraging theory research. And so that's why, in foraging, this idea of a fitness proxy. This, you know, that the, you know, this question has come up, in the UCE, is that, this, the reason we come up with things like gain over time is because it's really hard to measure the fitness of a foraging strategy, because you can't follow an animal over its whole life and say an animal with this foraging strategy had this many offspring, and an animal with this foraging strategy had this many offspring. So what do? You have to come up with short-term proxies we actually can measure in the lab or in the field. And so a lot of times there are these mathematical expressions that represent opportunity costs, that represent how much gain did you get and how little foraging time. So that idea of a proxy, that it's, we don't know for sure that gain over time is, that is not fitness, but we think that it's correlated with fitness. That's kind of a fundamental concept. And in foraging, the proxy we tend to go back to time and time again, not all the time, but it's very influential, is rate of gain. So we introduced Holling's disk equation. So this idea that you've got prey density at low density, this is basically RK. So, at low densities, you're unlimited. So there's as the, or you're, I'm sorry, I guess what I'd say is at low densities, the more prey you get determines how much of a meal you have. So I guess you'd say, I guess you're limited here, but you're not limited by yourself here. So you're unlimited by your ability to eat at low densities. But at high densities, then it doesn't matter that the prey density has increased, because you can only eat so fast. So that idea of a type two functional response, that, this shape and what it means, that there's diminishing returns with increased density, and that, that has an effect on your foraging decisions, is important. And it, and this shape is all driven by the time it takes to handle prey. The quicker you can find a prey and eat it and move on, then the greater chance for you to actually reach higher and higher levels of rate of gain. So that's a fundamental concept. So that, that's the fundamentals of foraging right there. So then we went into specifics. Any questions? And I'm just trying to rapidly go through animal behavior, like, is, just to sort of remind us what we went over so that you guys can generate questions. I'm not going to ask you to recite this equation. I think the shape of this curve is more important, and knowing that the shape of this curve is basically set by handling time. So what's important to know about this equation is if you let H equal zero, so if I can eat prey immediately, this whole term goes away, and then the rate of gain just becomes basically how fast, how this is basically the density of the prey. So if you increase density, you increase rate of gain. The only thing that keeps this thing from being a straight line is how quickly you can eat. That's what I want you to know. Any other questions? Okay, so right. So then the we so there's a bunch of different ways that you can be a predator. So I would say, I'm not going to ask you to redraw this graph, but I would say, knowing that there's these different strategies that we've there's sit and wait ambush predation is very different than pursuit predation. The knowing the difference between parasitism and predation. In predation, you actually kill your prey, and parasitism, you just take little bites out of your prey, or you steal stuff from your prey. So, and then there's parasitoidism, which we didn't really talk about that much, but I'm just throwing it in there as an interesting case where these are predators that sort of slowly kill their prey, which is why they fit into this. So a parasitoid is, very often an insect that lays their eggs inside another living organism, and then gradually those eggs develop and eventually will kill that organism. So it's like a parasite, but it's actually a parasite that kills the host. So it's also like a predator, and that's where the parasitoid comes in. So, knowing that there's a bunch of different ways in which you can get your food, get your energy, get your resources is good to know. Of course, we focused, these, here, sit and wait, it's important where you sit and wait. In pursuit predation, you manage encounter rate by tracking and hunting mobile prey. But then, kind of the really cool stuff happens, I think, here, where you're not hunting and tracking a specific prey. In this case, you might actually be, your prey might be plants. Those are the living organisms you're eating. So here, this is where really interesting time management strategies come into play. How long do I stay here? When do I move there? Do I eat this when I could be taking that time to eat that? And so on and so forth. And so this is kind of the more interesting case here. And these types of strategies fall into that. They're often described by the frameworks that we talked about. So this is me just saying sit and wait is just where you sit and wait. Active hunting, that's where the searching opportunity here becomes more important. And that was going to bring us into this idea of what different aspects of handling time. So a central place forager is one that not only has to find prey, but they have to bring it all the way home before that prey can be handled. So that means their handling time actually increases by the distance from their home. So as you get farther from home, the handling time of your prey gets greater and greater, and it causes you to shift your decision making. So prey close to home are going to have a different handling time than prey farther from home. So that, if you think of that in terms of the prey choice model that we'll cover, later, then that should sort of tell you that higher profitability prey are closer to home than lower profitability prey. If you can, you stay close to home, you don't go farther away from home, and that's expected from prey choice theory. So this idea that, where handling time is the major limiter of these predators. So where are the handling times from? They're not all from just eating the prey, they're also from travel, which I think is kind of interesting. This notion of a patch. So it's not just finding the prey, it's deciding how long to stay in an area where prey are clumped. So definitely a very important concept to know. The difference between patchily distributed prey and more sort of uniformly distributed prey. So that idea of patch. And with patch, then we have to say, how long do you stay in a patch before you look for a new patch? And that comes down to this curve again, where now this curve is how much gain you're getting out of any particular patch. So the time in the patch. And the gain you get. So you get a lot of gain up front, but then you start depleting the patch, so you don't get as much gain over here. So how long do you stay in the patch? And so that is where we learned about the marginal value theorem. Super, super important concept. Definitely should be able to answer qualitative questions about this. So, this idea that being able to read this is good. Like, so if I showed you this plot, knowing what this plot is saying, knowing that S1 represent patches that are very close together, S3 represent patches that are very far apart. Seeing that when patches are close together, you stay in every patch for a shorter time. As they get farther apart, you stay in those patches for a longer amount of time. Understanding this graph is super important. The MVT, the marginal value theorem. Generically, what the marginal value theorem tells us is if you have multiple patches, so here's three different patches. This one doesn't have much things in it. This one has a lot of things in it. This one has even more things in it. All three of these patches eventually deplete, but you can stay in this rich patch longer before it depletes to the same amount as this patch and this patch. So what you end up finding is across all patches within a habitat, you end up leaving the patches at the same instantaneous rate of gain. The slopes of these lines are the same. They're parallel lines, but this line intersects later than this line because it's a richer patch. So this idea that you stay in rich patches, that marginal value theorem predicts you stay in rich patches for longer than poor patches, and but that the rate of gain from each patch is equivalent. Now that we've learned about the ideal free distribution from a future unit, I hope it gives you more perspective into what's going on here. And the ideal free distribution, you end up getting a matching between the number of animals at a feeder and how high quality the feeder is. Here you've got one animal, but you get a new matching law where the matching is how much time that animal allocates. So in a high quality feeder, he allocates more time in that feeder than a low quality one. This is another version of the psychological matching law, but instead of playing out over a social context, it's playing out over a temporal context. But it's basically the same result as the IFD. You've got this parallel lines, but different allocations. So that's the big picture of the marginal value theorem. So being able to answer qualitative questions about this, like if I say, if I increase the quality of this patch, what would you expect an animal to do by the marginal value theorem? And it would say, oh, I might stay longer in that patch and stay less time in the other patches. And why would it say less time in the other patches? Because if you spend more time in a rich patch, it will increase the rate of gain you're getting from the environment, which will mean you'll stay less time in the other patches because they'll very quickly drop below that new threshold. So, any questions about that? This marginal value theorem, it's a really important core concept from basic animal behavior. Gesundheit. So, when you leave animal behavior, you definitely should like have this burned into your brain. Okay. So, from there, we said, okay, well, how do you make things more exciting? What happens when animals not only have to worry about, the opportunity cost? Well, you got to also stay safe. And so not only, you can't just always make the decision that maximizes your rate of gain if that might mean you'll die at the end of the day. So sometimes you have to make risky choices because the thing that maximizes the rate of gain isn't going to get you to the end of the day. So if you're going to die anyway, you may as well start doing riskier things because at least the riskier things have a chance, maybe a small chance, but at least there's some chance that you'll survive. So you start doing things that don't look like optimal foraging, but they are optimal. It's just using a different currency. So, had this example where it turns out you give a bird like this Junco. If it's hungry versus not hungry, it makes different foraging choices consistently in the lab. And so that is kind of explained by risk-sensitive foraging theory and this idea of stretch goals. And so if you've got a distribution of rewards that you can get from your foraging strategy, just this is like, at the end of the day, how much energy did you gather from the environment? Well, if you're lucky, you're up here. If you're unlucky, you're down here. So, how do you maximize the number of outcomes that are lucky? Well, for a stretch goal, you try to do strategies which make this a wider distribution. That will mean that you'll have that. Animals that do this, there would be a large number of animals that are going to get even less at the end of the day, but they're just as dead as these animals. So it doesn't really matter if you end up over here or over here, but there's a greater chance you're going to end over here if you widen this distribution. So this is the example of if you have rent to pay at the end of the month, and you have a choice between something that's definitely less than the rent you have to pay, or an envelope that's either way less than the rent you have to pay or way more than the rent you have to pay, even if they have the same average, you might seek out a variable reward as opposed to a constant reward. There's a guy in Kentucky who studies pigeons and how they're more interested in variable rewards, even when the mean is lower for those variable rewards. And that suggests to me that those pigeons probably evolved in an area where this was a common case, where it was, where the survival threshold was really important. But you could it'd be in the other case where your environments, if you're really unlucky, you die at the end of the day, but most of the time you survive. Well, in this case, you should conservatively do the thing like you should grab the envelope that always has the same amount of money in it. Don't ever risk it because why bother? It might be great to be over here once, but that one time you're over here, it's not a good thing. So this idea that thresholds and survival can totally shift foraging strategies. That's what we mean by risk-sensitive foraging theory. Being careful of survival thresholds and time, and using that to predict when an animal is likely to do a weird thing that maximizes its variance. So, any questions about that general idea? And that folds into this idea of bet hedging. And this is a little bit like the pigeon case, but on the other side of the line, it can be beneficial to sacrifice an average to go to shift your behavior so that your rewards from the environment actually, on average, do worse than another strategy, if that means that none of the outcomes cause you to die. So you can say, yeah, on average, I only get 100 calories instead of 150, but out of 100 days, I survive all 100 of them. Whereas if I get 150 calories, maybe one time in 100 days, I don't survive the night. And that's really important because, life is a lot of 100 days. So that's the idea of bet hedging, giving up mean in order to adjust variance. Paying down risk is the way we say this as well. You pay for the decreased risk by giving up mean. Okay, so that's risk-sensitive foraging theory. From there, we ended foraging, solitary foraging, with the prey model, optimal prey choice. And knowing the difference between prey and patch, I mean, this general idea that there's a bunch of prey items that you eat as lumped prey. So you eat them, it takes, in order to, if this quail happens to hit this prey item here, and eat it, so thumbs up, it's going to spend exactly this handling time and get, on average, this gain out of that prey item. It can't stop early. It can't stay later. So that's the idea of the prey model. So they're like seeds that you're eating. You eat the whole seed or none of the seed. And so then the question is, how do you explain when the quail turns down certain seeds and accepts other seeds? That's the general idea in this diet choice models. And so Holling's disk equation, it's a place where we start with these. Here we view Holling's disk equation as a measure of opportunity cost. That is the gain you're getting out of the environment for every unit of time you spend searching. So you're going to compare the profitability, which is gain over time, of your prey item to the opportunity cost from searching. If you can get more gain for that time searching, you turn down the item. If you can get more gain per time eating the item, then you give up on searching. That's the idea behind the prey model. And that ends up making a nice testable prediction that preferences will be sorted by this profitability. So if I've got a bunch of prey, then I can rank them by their gain over handling time. And there will be, as you enrich the environment, then that will start giving up on these prey items close to the background rate. So this will be the first one it'll start ignoring. You enrich the environment more, this will be the next one it ignores. You enrich the environment more, this will be the next one it ignores. But it'll never ignore this one that's the highest profitability. This also means that and this is a key result, that the rate that the decisions of the forager depend only on the rate of encounter with these prey items, not with these. If that prey item has a lower profitability that you're already ignoring it, it doesn't matter that it comes very often. The more often or less often, if you're already ignoring it, you keep ignoring it. That is a key prediction of the prey model. So, any questions about this profitability ranking? Another key result from classical animal behavior. Yeah. Profitability is like if it's a seed, this is the calories I get from the seed, and this is how long it takes for me to break the seed open and get them. Well, it do you say is it like one? Well, there are different units. So this is like calories per unit time. So they're in watts, basically. So this is I get for this seed, I get 100 calories per second of chewing. But this seed, I might get 50 calories per second chewing. So I have to eat more of these seeds to get, I have to take more time eating these seeds to get the same number of calories. Whereas this one, I take a little bit of time and I get a ton of energy. So it's like an energy density, but the density is per unit time. So, and likewise, the Pauling's disk equation is also in energy per unit time in watts. So this is for every time for the energy I get from searching, because I find things while searching, divided by the time it takes for me to both search and handle those things. So this is my background long-term rate of gain. This is how much energy I'm gradually absorbing from my environment. So this is how much energy per unit time I'm absorbing from a seed, how much energy I'm absorbing from the environment as a whole. So if the seed gives me a greater power intake than the environment as a whole, I eat the seed. And that affects how much power I get from the environment. Okay. So, yeah, and so this is that key result. Encounter rates with accepted prey are the only thing you care about. You don't really care about encounter rates with ignored prey. And that's a key prediction you can test experimentally. Yeah. Because if you let's say we pick on this ignored prey here, and let's increase its abundance totally. Every time you eat one of these that's less than this, it will make the long-term rate of gain go down. So the idea here is like every time you eat something, you're going to add the numerator to this numerator and the denominator to this denominator. So if you eat these things, it will make this background rate of gain go up until it reaches an asymptote. If you eat these things, it will make it go down. Absolutely. If you deplete it, so if you like say, all right, I'm going to take these seeds away from you, then this rate will fall. And then now you get a new fence post, and then these will be included in the diet. Yeah, right. So relative to now, if I change these encounter rates, nothing happens. But if I now change these encounter rates, those then move into this accepted set, and now their encounter rates matter. Okay. And then other constraints. So that's if everything, all else being equal, the optimal foraging theory predicts behaviors. But there's all of these additional complicating constraints that make animals act in weird ways. Risk was one of those that we already saw. But animals can be constrained not only by risk up here, but also their gut capacity, toxins that are in the food. So you can't eat enough. You can eat this food, it has a lot of calorie benefit, a lot of energetic benefit, but it also is very toxic. So you maybe have to eat it slowly because your body has to purge those toxins and it can only do that at a certain rate. Water, if you're really thirsty, you'll start eating things that are more have more water in them than when you're not. Even if those things that have more water in them have a low profitability. So there's a bunch of these different constraints. There are these weird things that happen. So weird animals like this sloth, they eat leaves, and they're up in a tree eating leaves. Leaves by themselves are do not have a lot of nutritional value. As a human being can't survive on lettuce alone. But the sloths have to find a way to do it. And the things they're not getting from the leaves, just like if you're a vegetarian, you might take supplements. Their supplements come from algae. But in order to get that algae, they have to get these moths on them, which are pictured here. And in order to get those moths, they have to take a costly visit down to the bottom of their tree to poop. And so this whole travel down the tree to poop is all to set up and complete the life cycle of moths that fly up and live in their hair that end up being involved by their death in their hair to produce this algae that is the supplement that these sloths need to survive. So nutrient constraints drive weird deviations from otherwise, normal behavior. So we talked about that in the case of water. So this was an experiment done in southern Arizona where you got these big old wolf spiders, and in a control case where they normally eat these large crickets, but then when you give them water, a little bowl of water, then they shift and then they eat little wolf spiders instead. So that sort of suggests to us that the reason they're eating the crickets is not because they're energetically rich, but because they're little juice boxes full of all sorts of gooey goodness. And once you give them water in other forms, then they go for things that are more energetically valuable, like smaller wolf spiders. So that's an example of how constraints shift your diet. And then the other example we did was the case of these mollusk-eating birds, molluscivore shorebirds, that have gizzards. Gizzards are like detoxification devices for bulk. So there's a you if you can't help but eat a mollusk without eating some ballast, eating some shell, you don't really get a lot of nutritional value out of the shell. So you got to crunch that shell up and get it out of your system just to get the little bit of mollusk meat out, and that puts a limit on your intake rate. And so there are frameworks that we are outside of the scope of this class, but they're basically are frameworks similar to prey choice frameworks that allow you to bring these constraints in, and they predict that your optimal diet will not be ranked by profitability. It'll be ranked in this other weird way that it's sort of a combination of profitability and how quickly you can process that prey item. And so when you combine those on this axis, then clever people have figured out how to draw a diet line that's identical to that diet divider in prey choice theory, but that diet divider in prey choice theory is a horizontal line here. The diet divider, when you take a ballast constraint into play, is this diagonal line predicting a different set of prey items. So what I'm trying to get out of this is when there's no constraints mentioned, you can use your intuition from optimal foraging theory. You can always use your intuition from optimal foraging theory about qualitatively, if something changes, do you imagine that you're going to get a shift upwards or downwards? But if you take an animal and then you move it into a very harsh environment with constraints that didn't exist in the old environment, you might get a total upheaval of its choice. And that's what I'm just trying to communicate in this section. And that's not a failure of optimal foraging theory. Optimal foraging theory didn't include these constraints. This is optimal foraging theory plus constraint. We don't need this constraint for most animals because most animals aren't eating bulky items. So that's why we use the simpler model for most animals. But for molluscivore shorebirds, we need a more complex optimal foraging theory. All right. So any questions about that? Right. So then we talked about social foraging. So a lot of cool stuff here about kind of tragedy of the commons. So this idea that, there's in human examples, there's a question of what's the optimal number of boats in a fishery? And you can say that if you could only get, four boats in the fishery, you can maximize the output of the fishery, but because the output of the fishery with four boats is greater than the output of the fishery with no boats, then or greater than the output to a fisherman who's not in the fishery, then you're going to get these sort of parasitic joiners that end up causing the benefits, the difference between benefits and costs, to go to zero, so that you get the open access equilibrium is no better than you'd be doing if you did not have access to the fishery. So that's the tragedy of the commons for humans, is that these resources, these renewable resources, are often overexploited to the point where their value is depleted, it goes to zero. And that same thing happens in animal models too. So We had this bat case where you can, even though there's a benefit of a some number of bats working together, there's nothing that keeps bats out. So you can get larger groups where they end up interfering with each other so much that they may as well be foraging alone. Same thing happens in wolves. So the general idea here is that if you forage alone, you get a certain fitness. If you join forces with another individual, that might mean the fitness goes up and it might keep going up, but because you can't keep other individuals out who's, effectively are stealing your food, then the group sizes you observe in nature, if there's no way to keep individuals out, often end up being at the same foraging rate that you get when you see individuals alone. And that sort of was a conundrum for a long time. And for the same reason, the tragedy of the commons is a conundrum in human systems. And that, though, now makes a lot of sense for the same reason it makes sense in human systems. So that idea of observed group sizes in nature are rarely at the fitness maximizing group size because you can't keep animals out. It was sort of an important concept. This example of wolves, where not only are their group sizes way above the fitness maximizing group size, but they're even larger because of those wolves have to also deal with birds getting into the mix. So that was a question there. But the big thing I want you to take out of this is not the wolf example specifically or the bat example specifically, but this just in general example that there are tragedies of the commons in animal models too. That group sizes in animals often are equivalent to the rate, the same intake rate as animals going alone. And that seems like a conundrum, but it makes a lot of sense. If you think about it, like it's just sort of a natural equilibrium of some animals assorting, and if they can't keep animals out, then they end up just getting back to where they started, and then other animals not wanting to join those groups. And so they get a smattering of groups of the open access group size and a smattering of individual animals, and that's just the way it is. So, questions about that, the group size stuff, tragedy of the commons, and animal models? Okay, so then producers and scroungers, other examples of exploitation. So I want you to know the producer scrounger idea that because it happens in a lot of animal systems, you get individuals that are looking for food and individuals that are looking for individuals looking for food. And the question is, are you going to be a producer or are you going to be a scrounger? And so there are models that help describe that. I would be interested in you knowing in the producer scrounger game that a key parameter is this A, which is the finder's advantage. So it is the amount of food that you get as a bonus for finding it first before everyone comes over and then starts picking away at whatever's left. And knowing that, if what happens when that number goes up, and what number goes up qualitatively, do we expect to see more producers or more scroungers as you change that amount there? Or just in general, as you make the environment richer or poorer? So is it easier to find food or harder to find food? How might you expect these things to change? That's kind of what I want you to get out of the producer scrounger stuff. All right. So that's exploitation. Any questions about that social exploitation and food? Okay, then we talked about habitat selection. So this is where the IFD, the ideal free distribution, comes into play, ducks on a pond. So you have multiple patches. Where do the ducks go? That's the key question in habitat choice. One answer to that is this ideal free distribution. It comes from the idea that you're either going to have interference competition or scramble competition. It's good to know the two types of competition. One of them is because you actually have an animal which keeps another animal out. The other one is just because you have a limited amount of food, and so it can't feed everybody. So somebody gets left out and not being able to feed. So, but both of those things can lead to an IFD scenario. And so, what is that scenario? And the idea is you've got two patches, one on one side of the pond, one on the other. This one's getting more breadcrumbs per second than this one. But as ducks arrive, then it leaves fewer breadcrumbs for free for other ducks to eat. So, Although there might be 5 breadcrumbs per minute coming out at one particular area, once you get a duck there, then for the next duck, they see, well, actually for both ducks at some point, they see 4 breadcrumbs, 3 breadcrumbs, and so on. So what you end up getting, similar to the marginal value theorem, is that across, even though this is a richer area and this is a poorer area, the ducks at the richer area get just as much food as the ducks at the poorer area. And that seems like a contradiction, but the way that's resolved is that there are more ducks at the richer area and less ducks at the poorer area. So the IFD is a matching between the number of ducks at different areas and the intrinsic quality of those areas. But it doesn't benefit you to be in either area. At the equilibrium, a duck here is getting just as much as a duck there. And that's because they're free to move. So if you could get more, if you're at the good area and no one's at the bad area, but there's so many people in the good area, it's depleting the amount you can get. You go over to the bad area and you actually do better. And that's what we're seeing here. So everybody starts in the good area. Once the good area becomes less good, you go to the bad area, which is gooder than the good area, I guess. And then then you go back and forth until eventually. If this is your population size, 2 plus 4, if there's 6 ducks, then this is where things equilibrate out, and this is the intake rate that all the ducks get, regardless of where they are. So, any questions about the IFD, another core principle? MVT and IFD. Okay. And so, as you increase the number of ducks, the equilibrium just moves down. It just gets worse for every duck as you increase the number of ducks. No duck is special. Okay. And like I said, it's just a social version of the matching law from psychology, where if you put a pigeon in a box, if this button gets rewarded more than this button, then this pigeon will spend more time pecking this button than that button. But if they both get rewarded, the pigeon will spend time. But if the reward rate is much higher here, it'll spend much more time here. Same thing's going on here, but instead of being an individual animal, it's a group of animals and how they distribute. Okay. So yeah, IFD, I'm just sort of summarizing that. And Nash equilibrium, this is, we started talking a lot about the Nash. This is our first introduction to it. If you're an individual duck, and all the other ducks stay in place, there is no value to you to deviate from the IFD. Thus, the IFD is a Nash equilibrium. If you can get other ducks to move, then it may be beneficial for you to move. So, if you can say, everybody over there, come over here. And then after they come over here, you go over there, that's better for you. But if you don't have any control over everybody else, if all of those are staying there and all of these are staying here, it's better for you to stay here. And that makes it a Nash. Okay. And that then allowed us to introduce the stag hare, which is like a nicer version of the prisoner's dilemma. So prisoner's dilemma, you'd swap the roles of A and B. You'd make this a 10 and that an 8. But in a stag hare, this is the goal here. The idea here is you've got a cooperative. Let's go both hunt a stag together, or go alone. Let's both just individually get our own rabbit. And so if you both cooperate, you both get a lot of gain. But if only but if you both look for hares, then you both do fine, but you just don't get that much. If one of you goes for a stag, and then you're probably not going to get it, and you're also not going to be eating the rabbits, so it'll be quicker for the other one to find a rabbit. So thus the stag hare. And the conundrum here is that it's both this corner and this corner are Nash equilibria. But one of them is payoff dominant. It's better to be here, but it's risky because you can't ever count. You don't know. You don't have any assurance that the other person's going to play stag. So if you're risk sensitive, then you will just go with the risk dominant one and you'll play hare because that's the easiest thing to do. But if you need the big win, then you might go to hare. So if you imagine, combine this with what we know about risk sensitivity from the earlier slide, if you have a harsh threshold, you might actually get a lot of cooperation. because that's the only way you can survive. And so you're willing to take the risk. But if you're going to survive fine anyway, then you're not going to risk getting stuck, looking for a stag and not getting it. And so, and when you're doing fine, it's you'll just go for the rabbit. All right, we're at time. Happy to take more questions, but I don't want to keep anybody more over that. So if you have any questions, feel free to come up. Feel free to email me. If everything works out well, the exam should go online tonight. No other clicker questions. So thanks.
Presentation
No, just
or
an effective use of the group members. So that doesn't mean that you all have to spend an equal amount of time. That might mean one person does a lot because it might be the other people were used in coming up with the idea or whatever. So whatever kind of makes sense.
okay, so it's kind of like two would be fine.
I think two would be fine. I mean, in the rubric, it just sort of says, actually, it doesn't say anything about group members in
Yeah,
the
it
rubric.
just says an efficient use of time.
Yeah. So as long as you can efficiently use the time, I don't want you like forcing like, well, here's a thought that I couldn't finish because I hit my 2.5 minutes,
Yeah.
but I'm going to let my colleague finish. Like that just seems weird.
Okay. So if like three people made more of the presentation and that stuff, and one person presented,
I think that's fine.
you think
Yeah.
as long as it's like internally
Yeah, I
between
think,
us and we're okay with it?
right. I mean, if there was one person, for example, that didn't do anything, then I would
Yeah.
assume that when you submit your presentation, you just leave their name off the cover and then I would investigate that.
Okay.
So if everybody's putting their names on the cover, then I'm just sort of assuming that you're all okay with the
And that
presentation.
we all did our okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Quick question for you. Just to clarify, so it doesn't actually need to be exactly over 10 minutes as long as the rubric criteria.
Right. In fact, I encourage, let me just turn off the recording here. I encourage it to be.